This is Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
JBL Tour Pro 3 earbuds are for those who don't conform to the standard.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to get into some touchscreen technology, how about the smart charging case, clear sound? These are not standard things. You're only going to get them with the JBL Tour Pro 3, baby.
And I love the sound of JBL when it goes... These earbuds are packed with innovation because you can't stand out by following others.
Touchscreen smart charging case for one-touch control, instant EQ customization, true adaptive noise canceling, and the one-of-a-kind audio transmitter, which can plug and play with everything from game consoles to in-flight entertainment. What more could you want? First doesn't follow. Grab a pair at JBL.com.
At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it, your neighbors know it, heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
Today on The Grave Talks, The House in Between, a conversation with John Villard. John Villard would spend much of his childhood wondering where the strange whispers he heard were coming from. Eventually, he'd get validation for his paranormal experiences by capturing the dead's voice on tape. This would lead him on a journey to show the rest of the world that we are not alone in the living realm. This would lead him to investigate what would become known as the House in Between, a house that would hold more spirits than anyone could understand.
Yeah, so... you know, what really got me into the paranormal, I was about 10 or 11 years old. So like you said, I was a younger child. My grandparents lived in a small town in Mississippi called Brookhaven, Mississippi, and not necessarily known for Victorian houses or mansions or anything like that. But there were a few very old houses, late 1800s. And my grandfather actually owned a couple junkyards, and he also did estate sale stuff as well. And I remember going with him several times to different houses and places. And there was two houses in that town that I remember going into doing an estate sale. And I would see figures, like shadow figures, across the wall, up the stairs. And I would hear people murmuring and whispering when it was just me and my grandfather inside the house. Sometimes he'd be outside loading stuff and I was inside and I would just hear talking. And that kind of resonated with me, and I never told anybody. I didn't tell my parents. I didn't tell my grandfather because I just figured it was my imagination, and they would just laugh it off anyway. And going forward the next few years, going to high school and whatnot, there would be random places that I would go to, whether it was somebody's house or just, you know, just random places that I would get vertigo where I got real dizzy. And again, I would hear whispers, and it just – it always kind of just – brought me back to my childhood experience in Brookhaven. So I started doing research on the paranormal. This is probably 2006, 2007, and just kind of looking about, you know, looking up haunted places, supernatural, the theories behind why something may be haunted, and then obviously locations that are, you know, supposedly haunted. So 2007, 2008, I decided to take myself and two friends to King's Tavern, which is in Natchez, Mississippi. Which is a late 1700s building, very, very famous. Ghost Adventures have been there. John Zaffis has done something there. So what's neat is I knew that this place had a long history of being active and haunted. So I wanted to validate what I experienced over the last few years as a child and try to capture something. And we went in not knowing anything about the paranormal, supernatural. And the two people who came with me, they just tagged along because they were friends. So we went in with some very low-key equipment, and we had the little tape recorder, you know, little tapes you used to use for your answering machine.
Sure.
That's a little small. Yeah. So we had some analog stuff, some digital stuff, and we were just kind of poking around. And we went into the investigation the wrong way. I wanted anything to happen, every creak, every noise. I was like, could that be something? So we were in there for several hours and didn't really get any activity. And lo and behold, about, I would say, the last hour and a half, 2 hours of that investigation that night, we had a door swing wide open and scared the hell out of us. And once we captured it, it was just that aha moment for me, and it validated that what I experienced as a child, it wasn't just my imagination, that there's maybe something actually to this in this field. So that became my obsession with the paranormal, you know, really just documenting evidence and trying to understand the why for the what. And audio has always been a big thing for me because, you know, there's a lot of skeptics in the field and in the world, and that's a good thing. It keeps us honest to what we do. But even if you have a skeptic who does not believe in the supernatural or the paranormal, and you're capturing some really clean, crisp audio that's intelligent, full sentences, you know, you have to have a conversation with those people. If it's not fake, what is it? So that's always been something that intrigued me, and it's some of the best things that we can capture in the field, obviously, besides something that's full body or an object moving. But, you know, and your vocal tone is unique to yourself, so it's just like your fingerprints. None of your fingerprints are the same. That's why they fingerprint you if you get arrested. Your vocal tone is very similar. So it's interesting to see EVP software. You know, we've actually got recordings of a guy who lived in a house who passed away, and we saw his vocal tone pattern from a recording, and we put an EVP pattern up there. It is pretty similar. It's pretty neat to go into that side of the audio and the EVP. So you try to get into as much scientific stuff as you can. But jumping back to King's Tavern, once I captured that first EVP, it really just set me on the trajectory that I wanted to be able to document authentic, clean evidence and let people be able to listen to it. Because I knew a lot of people who were into the paranormal, but they were never going to invest the kind of time that it takes to do it correctly. So it's just one of those things. And this is not a knock to anybody who does this, but, you know, when groups put a video up of them investigating some mansion and it's an hour and 20 minute video, well, nobody's going to watch it. Okay. Because nobody wants to watch you bumble around in the dark for an hour and maybe a light goes off for you. You know, it's just, that's a long process. And that's why, you know, it takes a quality show like Ghost Nation or Ghost Adventures. And usually if they do a location, they're filming for 3 or 4 days, sometimes a week, and it's condensed to 45 minutes. So I always tell people, you know, I love paranormal. I love this field, but it is not as sexy as it seems like on TV.
No, I mean, there's a lot more that goes into production than people will go, whoa, it's overproduced. It's like, well, they had to make something out of their 3 days of footage that would be viewable. Yeah. So, I mean, does it seem condensed and on top of each other? Yes, but that's how you make television. For you, when we're talking about audio versus visual things that people capture or you capture, what to you, this is just a personal question, what's more convincing to you when you see evidence? What draws you to it as more valid than the other, audio versus visual?
That's a great question. And I'm an audio guy, so I lean towards audio just because, you know, made an imprint on that recording, right? So like that had to be something. Now, whether it's a parallel universe, you want to get in that topic, or whether it's residual, whether it's an intelligent haunting, you know, we've gotten EVPs of me walking down a stairwell and it says John's walking down. So like there's different things that are specifically calling your name and directly responding to what you're doing in the moment. And if it's not fake, you know, again, you have to have that conversation. So I guess for me, I look at it as the biggest skeptic in the world. If I bring them this evidence, they're going to give me pushback. But what's the best thing that I can sit down and have a conversation with where this is going to make them scratch their head? And obviously on the flip side, audio is great. But if you can capture physical evidence, I mean, it's like the Holy Grail. Obviously, if you have a full body apparition or manifestation, or if you watch The House in Between, which I'm sure we'll get to in a few minutes, there's a reason why we chose to do what we did. There's a reason why when I realized that, then you have to have a conversation of, okay, something propelled this object forward. Mm-hmm. Now we got to have a conversation. And even if it is scientific, you're at least having the conversation of science and supernatural together. And I think that's a small win, even for a big skeptic.
Yeah, to try and figure out if there is something logical that's happening there. When you got that experience at King's Tower, where you had obviously those experiences in the past, and you got your validation there. Did you need the validation though? Once you got that EVP on tape, and you look back on it kind of retrospectively, had you already been in a mindset of, I accept this as being real. I know these things happened. Did personally truly validate much for you, or was it more just, yep, I know this stuff is real. You know, that is the definition of validation, but were you already pretty much convinced there that there's something going on?
I was, because it happened so many times for me. I just knew that it was there. I think it was more validation for the people around me, as in like the two people who were with me. It's like, see guys, I'm not crazy, but just getting their buy-in also, because once, the two people with me at the time, what they experienced, it really just sold them also. And that put us on our journey for almost a decade. We created Smoke and Mirrors Paranormal, and I had an audio guy and a girl who was doing the historical side of it for me. And
sure,
after that location, it just really got their buy-in. And I think that's what I wanted, as I wanted somebody along with me on the journey, because I knew that this was real, but I just needed that validation. And I think going back to what I told you also, I wanted to be able to document clean evidence for people to listen to, is I wanted to show the world from just an individual standpoint that this stuff is real, and build that trust and respect in the field so people could come and see what we capture, click, listen, and move on, because I know people's attention spans are very short. That's why we made our stuff very easy to click, listen to, and then, you know, have your opinion on it and move on.
When you say clean evidence, obviously that is kind of a term that one could, if you're into the paranormal, go, wow, that's really clear and clean. And if you're not, you listen to it and you may go, I think that's very hard to understand. I mean, it's really a lot of times in the eye of the beholder. What do you mean by clean evidence? I mean, for some, no matter what you put in front of them, they could see the apparition and hear the voices and still be like, it's a dog, you know. But for others, you can convince them. So what do you define as clean evidence in as layman term as possible for someone who's listening, who is not an investigator and doesn't know what a class A or a class B anything is? Just how do you define it?
Right. So with audio specifically, you talk about class A, B, C, and that's how clear it is to hear. Is it, you know, how many words is it a full sentence? Is it just one word? So how we kind of gauge things is if, you know, we usually listen to raw audio with headphones, and if we can't hear it off the headphones, and because we don't want to doctor anything, yeah, besides maybe enhancing it a little louder, that's about as far as we would ever go. So if it's not raw and where you can hear it with your own ears, we usually don't put it up. There's a lot of things that you can listen to, and we think we understand what it's saying, and you definitely need to wear headphones to listen to this. So those things we kind of stay away from. If it's not just right in your face on the audio side,
yeah,
we're just going to kind of holster it and not put it out there for people to be, you know, because it, and again, we put subtitles so we can tell you what we think. But on the video side of it, you know, the light anomalies and all that stuff, we stay away from that stuff. I mean, there's definitely some validity to it, obviously. But unless it's like a door swinging or something, literally in the video you see moving, we're not going to put it up there. But again, you are right. Everybody's going to have their skeptic side to them and say, well, you know, that floor could have been tilted, or he walked when that mat moved, so that could have affected it. So there's always going to be those pushbacks, which we're okay with. But we just don't want to have the evidence where they're like, hey, guys, watch this. This is crazy. And you watch the 2-minute video and you're like, what the hell am I looking at? You know, so sure, it's going to be something that's more in your face. And then again, on the audio, something that you can click and listen to. Like one example, we did a investigation in McRaven home, which Ghost Adventures just recently did when they did the Vicksburg episodes. And one of the best EVPs I've ever captured, it's got like a British accent to it that says, that's a funny old clock. And such a really, really just, it's a full sentence. The room we captured it in has a big clock in it. So that's one of those things where you listen to it, you can show people and they're like, wow, that's wild. You don't, you know, they don't have to interpret, what did she say again? You know, so whenever you can play an audio for 10, 15, 30 people and they get it the first time, that's what I mean when I say clean evidence, mm-hmm. that you don't have to, you know, try to interpret anything.
Let me ask you this, and this is, and I'm curious from an investigator standpoint, we're in this world now where folks like yourself are able to capture clean evidence, as you're describing, you know, that is just so convincing, so obvious. There is something you got. Yet, in a greater whole, the scientific community will look at these sort of things and scoff and be like, no, there's, you know, we don't believe in that. This is, where are we in terms of getting some of these things and the evidence that's being captured? Yes, when shared amongst other paranormal investigators and enthusiasts, you know, you can look and the people who know what they're looking at will go, wow, that was really amazing and great. But outside of that circle of those who accept the paranormal as just being factual, it's just looked at as whatever, you know, that it doesn't mean anything to many people. Are we getting anywhere closer where you can have things like that, pieces of evidence that clearly, you know, you can look at it and hear, and it's right there, and it wasn't doctored, and we can show it wasn't doctored. Are we getting anywhere closer to those areas being accepted more so in the scientific community as being fact and as being looked as true evidence, not just within the realm of ghost hunters that are out there?
I think yes and no. I think yes. And you watch The House in Between, and there's other shows who use scientific, you know, people as well. Mm-hmm. But if you, you know, some of the evidence that we showed Dr. Dye and, you know, they couldn't answer it. So, you know, it does make them scratch their head. So that's cool to see. On the flip side of it, I think that unfortunately there are a lot of people just, you put the paranormal and supernatural and ghost hunters in a big box, and then they just assume that anything that comes out of that box is just red flag,
yeah.
or it's got an asterisk beside it. So, you know, there's people who are biased who just, they're not going to believe that or be associated with it. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because some of the people that we tried to get to come test levels on the house for the documentary, or doctors, professors that we tried to reach out to, they wanted nothing to do with the film, which is understandable, but that shows you that they just don't want to have their names associated with it because they're scared to be associated with it.
Yeah.
There are several people that we got tried to be, you know, that initially signed off on the film, and then they called back and they're like, nah, I'm going to pass.
Well, it's like, what type of evidence is it going to take for the scientific community as a whole, the broader, more mainstream, to really start taking a closer look at these things and go, what the hell is this? I mean, it's intriguing as heck, but what is it going to take? You know, we're beyond the world of, you know, Ouija boards or seances or just a psychic. I mean, obviously those things are out there, but we have so much in-depth greater evidence that exists now that is documented that we can take a look at. Why are we still kind of sitting here, and why is that world still looked upon as, you know, witchcraft and things of that nature that people will just easily dismiss?
Right. And I agree with you. And it is frustrating at some point. I do think that we need to take this conversation that you and I are having right now and really listen to it, because every time, whether you're an investigator who's been investigating for 2 weeks or you've been doing it for 15, 20 years or longer, every time you step into an investigation, you need to do your due diligence and really think about what you're doing, try to get the best data that you can. And if something is in doubt, you got to throw it out.
Sure.
You know, it's that old saying. And because unfortunately, there are people still in the field who are kind of reckless and they don't do their due diligence, and they can give the field a bad name. And they're, you know, one bad apple can spoil the bunch.
Yeah.
And that's still where we're at in the paranormal field right now. And it is more widely accepted now than it was even 10 years ago. So you have a lot more paranormal groups that are, yeah, in the field, and they're learning and they're testing out stuff, and all the people are creating new paranormal tools, and some of them are a lot more hokey and they don't really work. And, you know, there's not really a respectable point to try to bring them into an investigation. So there's a lot of different factors that I think factor into creating that consistent validity for the film or for the field. So I think that if all the investigators can continue to get on the same trajectory and path, and I think we'll be a lot more respected. And I think the field is. I think the field's more respected now than it was years ago.
Sure.
And the temptation that people have captured is one of those things where they may not respect it and want to dive into it, but privately they're like, what the hell is this stuff? Because there is such great evidence that's documented. And like, again, you see in the film, you can try to debunk it because that's what we try to do with the documentary. We wanted to bring anybody in that could give us an explanation because we're not automatically saying this is supernatural paranormal. We can't figure it out. It seems like it is to us. So, and that's why we linked up with Steve, because he has such a great reputation in the field, Ghost Hunters, Ghost Nation, and he is a very straight edge person. So, you know, we wanted to put the house to the test. We weren't trying to just say, hey, this is supernatural and spooky, come check it out. Mm-hmm. I mean, we wanted to figure it out. And the thing is, nobody could figure it out.
And that's, it's almost like there's oversaturation. It's almost like the Wild West right now with the world of paranormal, as doctors would have been in the Wild West, where you have your snake oil salesman and you have legitimate doctors who were trying to do the best with the technology of the time. But even legitimate doctors oftentimes were looked at as quacks and such when you have a field that at that point in time had a majority that were either unqualified or were out there, you know, just not knowing what the hell they were doing. I think we have that with the paranormal. There's plenty that are very fact-based, science-based that can pull up good evidence. But when you have just sheer numbers that outweigh that does make sense as to why the field itself as a whole still gets kind of looked at as like, well, kind of a pseudoscience, when in fact, no, it's not. It's just, you know, consider your sources of who you're getting the information from. Let's talk about the house in between. I know you've mentioned it several times. I know that there's a documentary now out about it. It's very very convincing, very interesting. The audience knows little to nothing about it. Set this up for us. Tell us about how you came to learn about the house in between and give us some background on the house itself. What drew you to it? Give us the backstory before we jump into investigating and such.
Yeah, for sure. So I did not do a lot of private residence investigations. I more did historical places selfishly because that's what I enjoy. I love history, and it was neat to be able to go to some of these mansions with $3 million of furniture inside, and they would let us poke around and prod and do an investigation. So, you know, always fun. And, you know, travel and the history side of the paranormal is a big part of it. And I had some really bad experiences with private residences as well. I actually went to a house that's in South Mississippi one time with me and my two investigators, and we walked into this residence, which we do questionnaires and we ask people questions, and we set up our questionnaire to kind of make them trip up on themselves, basically saying is if they're lying, we'll be able to tell in the questionnaire usually that their story's conflicting. But she seemed pretty legitimate on the phone. We drove down, it was about a 3-hour drive. And we walked in. The house was absolutely disgusting. She had two small children. I should have called child services is what I should have done. And after that moment, I swore off private residence investigations because, you know, that's a whole nother level. If somebody is willing to open up their door and let you in their life, in their house, like they are in need, whether it's psychological, obviously it's not always supernatural. More times than not, it's not. But, anyway, so that was probably 2 or 3 years. I did nothing but historical locations. We went to like Bliskak's Murder House. We went to a really cool place in Jamaica, Rose Hall. So we were just bouncing around doing places that we were interested in. And a friend called me and said they had a nurse who lived in Florence, Mississippi, which was only about 30, 40 minutes away from where I live in Mississippi. And so she had some stuff going on. She had it going on for a while. She didn't feel comfortable talking about it, but she's had some dramatic things happen inside her house, and she's at the point where she's willing to talk to somebody to see if she can get some answers. So I was intrigued, and the friend was a credible person. So I went and had a conversation. I met Miss Alice for the first time, and meeting her, and if you watch the documentary, she's just such a genuine person. She's so giving. She's one of the nicest, sweetest ladies that I've ever met. And I could tell when I sat down with her that she was not lying. She was legitimately scared and confused. She wanted to understand what was happening inside the house, And the house was built in the 90s, so it's not your traditional old scary looking haunted house. It's just a house. It's a beautiful house, A-frame red house. And ever since she built it in the 90s, they had things happen on the property and the land, like the doorbell would ring. They would have tools that were being moved when the house was being built. But when I met her, I guess 13 years ago now, things started to become more dramatic the last 5 or 6 years. And it got to a point where she stopped staying in the house. And that affected me also. So if something is happening that dramatic to where a lady has to leave her house, that's insane. And then being inside the house with her, we were sitting on the couch, and I remember to my left was a stairwell that goes up to an upstairs room. And I saw a shadow figure out of my left eye, and it was black, and it moved fast paced up the stairs. And I actually didn't tell Alice this until about a year ago. She had no idea the story even existed, but that's really what locked me into Miss Alice and her story. Is that shadow figure brought me back to when I was 10 or 11 years old, the stuff that I would used to see in Brookhaven with my grandfather. That was some of the exact same things that I experienced. So I had an event, or I had something happen to me within 30 minutes being inside the house. So I knew that she wasn't lying. I knew this is something that was valid. And that's kind of what started me on my path to come in and start doing a first official investigation inside the Mississippi house.
How long was she not staying in the house for?
Let's see. Ever since I met her, so that would be so close to a decade now, she has not stayed in the house. She'll go by during the day. She has mail and stuff that comes there, and she'll poke around. And obviously, if we come over there to do something, she'll be there. But she doesn't physically sleep and stay at the house.
So what is it used for? I mean, what, I guess my question would be, why would you hold on to a house that you can't make your home?
That's a good question, and I've asked her that before. But she built the house for her family. Her husband died, and her daughter lived in Alabama. So she lives about 20, 30 minutes away, and she's financially well off, and the house, I believe, is paid for. So she didn't really see a need to sell it. And she had several friends that were traveling nurses that would come and stay at the house every now and then, and they'd have experiences. But she kept it, I guess, as a convenience for them as well. So she just never had the intent to sell it, and she still doesn't.
Yeah.
I've asked her that several times and several other people, but you just tell when somebody asks her that, she has no intention of ever selling the house.
Interesting. So she had these experiences that got to the point where she literally could not stay there anymore. What is going through her mind at that point when she's like, okay, I can't stay here anymore, I'm calling some people? What's the intent? Is she wanting to rid the place of what's going on? Is she looking for answers? Is she looking just for validation that she's not crazy? What was it when kind of you stepped in there and that relationship began?
The number one thing I think she wanted was validation and documentation. So she wanted to understand that she wasn't crazy. She is a psych nurse. So she was like, well, maybe I've been in the psych ward too long. Maybe sure. I'm starting to go crazy.
Yeah.
But no, she wanted validation. And then I wanted to give her some documentation so she could understand that the things that she heard or saw, like, they're real. It's not a figment of her imagination. So that was my number one goal. And we've captured some really, really interesting audio in there, which is actually not in the documentary. You know, there's a lot of different stuff that we've captured over the years, but we didn't want to muddle and just bog down the documentary just full of the paranormal. We wanted to go a big human interest route to show Alice's story and her and everybody involved, mixed with the scientific side, and then mix in the supernatural as well. And there's a lot of story to tell. And I think the first part of The House in Between is just the first chapter of what's going on, because the house obviously is still active. But yes, going back, so she wanted validation and to understand, though, there's actually some lights that occurred in her bedroom. There were bright white blinding lights, and she woke up and she was just so confused. Again, she didn't know if this was like UFO. She didn't know if it was like ghosts. She didn't know if it was like a parallel universe. All of it sounds crazy to her, because she doesn't know anything about it, you know. And we do live in Mississippi. It is southern. It is the Bible Belt. There's like a 80-foot cross down the road from her. It's not one of those things that you just go run and tell your neighbors about. And Alice is so sweet, and she's a very private lady as well. So for her to reach out, it came to that tipping point where, you know, she just needed somebody to make her understand that she wasn't crazy. So, and really the process of going into the first investigation, I was so excited. It's been a while since I was that excited to go into a location, and it was pretty quiet the first night, the first investigation. We got a few different things, but I knew that this was going to be an ongoing process. And what's interesting about the house is, and I've learned this over the years, we do believe that there's two spirits that are attached to the land, a male and a female, and that the house is a portal of some sort, and it's almost like a revolving door, which sounds crazy until it's not. But whenever you go into the house, the energy is always different. I feel like it's always evolving. And it's interesting as well that you mentioned mediums earlier, and I have a twofold thought process on mediums. I think there are people out there who definitely have that ability, and it's truly incredible. I think that there's people out there who do not, who ask leading questions, and they muddle the field, like we were talking about earlier with the paranormal and why it's not taken seriously. That's the same thing with mediumship. Because there's people out there who are snake oil salesmen,
sure,
and there are people who have true abilities. But we've had about four or five different mediums from all over the country come to the house, some that are very well respected that I truly believe in. And it's interesting not meeting each other. The consensus from all of them in the house throughout the different parts of the years is that the house is a portal, like a spirit hotel, where entities come and gather strength to cross over. And that story was out of three of five mediums, very, very concise, that don't know each other. So I thought that was interesting.
And I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the identities of some of these people, but I want to take a step back. When you started doing an investigation there and you started to realize there's something going on here, but the owner of the home, you know, she's not a ghost investigator. She's curious as to what's going on and wanting to get some answers and learn whether or not there's something going on with herself or other people are experiencing this too. When you were able to come back to her and say, look, you're not crazy, we're experiencing things too, what was her reaction? I mean, is it comfort? Is it thank goodness? Is it okay, get rid of it? What is her mindset when you're coming back and saying, look, we're getting stuff too, you're not alone here?
She was overjoyed, so happy, and she wanted to find out more. It's almost like she wanted to understand why whatever was here. Is it intelligent? Is it just something that was on the land? So it was, she became like off the cuff. She was like an investigator asking all the right questions. It was so funny, but she was definitely overjoyed. She was excited. She wasn't scared. She didn't ask to get rid of them. She just wanted to know more and understand why what was happening at her house was happening.
And at this point, was she already not staying there? She had already, did she move to a different home, or what's her setup at that point?
Yeah, she was already not staying at the house. When I met her, she was not staying at the house.
That wraps up the first part of our conversation with John about the house in between. Search the house in between to find out locations to watch this documentary. In part two of our conversation, what was the house in between's owner's reaction when she started learning that there were several spirits in the home? And as John began investigating, how did he come to that conclusion to believe that two resident entities we're living there, along with a portal to the other side? Does the longer the same individual investigates a location increase the odds of activity taking place? John says the home's energy changes almost every time he visits. How negative or positive does an energy get? And how is a portal created in a home, and can the living close it if they wanted to? All that and more in part two of our conversation. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio. When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio. Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it. Your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs, in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio. When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio. Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it. Your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs, in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio. When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio. When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio. When it comes to broccoli salad, Ohio, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. Everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows that tangy zip. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip in all your favorite recipes. Buy now and get your tang on, Ohio. Truth is, Ohio, when it comes to broccoli salad, you got the secret ingredient on lock. Miracle Whip. You know it. Your neighbors know it. Heck, everyone from Toledo to Portsmouth knows it. That tangy zip of Miracle Whip is the reason why Ohio's broccoli salad runs circles around everybody else's and never gets winded. So here's to you for keeping it bold, keeping it zippy, and keeping Miracle Whip right where it belongs, in all your favorite recipes. Buy Miracle Whip at your local grocery store and get your tang on, Ohio.
This time of year, most of us are checking off our holiday gift lists. But identity thieves have lists too, and your personal information might be on them. Protect your identity with LifeLock. LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second and alerts you to threats you could miss. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Make this season about joy, not identity theft, with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.